Anthony, can you take us back to the, I suppose, the beginning of the Belfast Project, when you started to kind of collect the oral histories? I mean, when was that?
The first oral history interview would have been carried out around February 2001. I have a distinct memory of carrying it out at that time because my daughter was just born around the time when we began, and I've always associated the two events. In my mind, there's a link between them.
And at the time, what did you see? What did you feel the purpose of it was? You know, what was the, what were you starting out on?
Starting out on a journey of bringing voices in to the overall historical narrative. I have a view of history. I mean, given that I've done some historical training and have an interest in it, I have a view of history that one history becomes dominant to the extent that it manages to suppress or marginalise another. And therefore, I think it's very important to have as many voices in a historical narrative. And it adds more colour, complexity, shading to the tapestry that is history. And you know, over the course of decades, we have been moving history away from the kings and queens, the generals and prime ministers, the politicians and judges, and we've been getting the history of the subjects rather than the rulers, the prisoners rather than their jailers, the voter rather than the voted. And I've always thought that it's very important to get voices out that are different from what the norm is.
Between you and Ed Maloney, I mean, you interviewed quite a number of Republicans.
Well, we interviewed 26 people at the Republican side of the project.
And then there was a kind of a loyalist side to it as well.
There was a loyalist side to it, but I have absolutely no idea who was interviewed there. Ed would know. I don't have any idea.
But from a Republican side, I mean, did it cover kind of a wide spectrum of different Republican views, or did it tend to be folk who were less enamoured with the IRA and Sinn Féin by that stage, or you know, was it a reasonably wide range?
Within its range, it sought to cover all manner of Republicanism. Its first purpose, obviously, was to make sure that the whole project was protected. And one of the criteria for interviewing people was the reliability in terms of confidence. Would they go off blurting it? And so those things were taken into consideration. And in many senses, that would have made it difficult to get as many Sinn Féin people as I would have liked to have got. And I don't want to give any details away about the type of people that I interviewed, but I interviewed people primarily for their knowledge of republicanism and not for their gripes or their animosities or their critiques. I didn't go out and say, right, he or she might be useful because they don't like Gerry Adams or they don't like the ceasefire. I was prepared to talk to a wide range of Republicans. But as you can imagine, with the criterion of confidentiality on the part of the interview, that would restrict the pool. For example, if I had went to somebody in the local IRA company, the chances are that that person would have run off and told Sinn Féin, and then the project could have been in trouble. There was a prudent approach taken. But I think that when the whole archive eventually does come out, at whatever point in the future, people will be pleasantly surprised at the range of views enlisted.
The first time that the archive, in a sense, has gone public, really, was with two of the contributors had died, Brendan Hughes and David Irvine. Reasonably big names, I guess, with big stories, particularly Brendan's point of view. And Ed Maloney kind of wrote that up into a book, and I think there's a documentary, and you've kind of Voices from the Grave. Did you expect that might be the pattern for subsequent contributors over time?
No, not at all, Alan. The problem there was that Brendan Hughes had insisted while he was alive that he wanted his interviews published then. Now, that would have seriously jeopardised the project, I thought. So we had to persuade him to hold his wish, as they say, and we promised him that at some point we would do our utmost to get his story out there. And I did say to him, because he was insistent on this, and I did say to him that if he ever died on us, we used to slag him quite a lot, about Jerry carrying him up the road and telling everybody he was supportive of the peace process. So that sort of banter went on, but I had told Brendan on occasion that no matter what, I would endeavour to get his ratings out. And then Boston College, in the interest of balance, mm-hmm. and the also to promote their own image of being a sort of mediator, bridge builder, in what they were like to refer to as the two sides in the Northern conflict, it was their idea to push the David Irvine narrative as well.
I haven't got to that bit of the book yet, so don't spoil it, but Detective is going to be quite a different. It's going to be less about what actually happened and more maybe about what he felt and thought and his analysis of what was going on, maybe, rather than details of action.
Well, I think you also have to bear in mind that the UVF, the organisations to which David Irvine once belonged, give approval to the people's involvement in this, mm-hmm. And what restrictions they may have put on that approval or that decision, I do not know. But the fact that they were involved also underscores another point, and that was that the UVF actually met with, as a corporate body, met with representatives of Boston College, and one of the issues that they raised was would the material be resistant to not just a court order, because they said they were quite satisfied with Boston College's assurances that it would be resistant to any court order, but they didn't want the PSNI getting a sneak look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told that under no circumstances would the PSNI get a sneak look at it. So, in many ways, I think that underlines the point that has been made from the outset that Boston College very much give these guarantees of unlimited confidentiality.
If there wasn't going to be kind of a succession of books and kind of narratives, how did you expect the tapes or the kind of interviews to be used? Did you kind of reckon it would be something for like the next generation of history researchers would kind of pick them up and kind of look at them all together after kind of another 30 years? Or did you think actually some of them would be critiqued and stuff would get published or at least kind of researched as time went on?
Well, I think it's safe enough to say now that some of the people who have been interviewed for the project are dead.
You mentioned that in the RTE interview the other day, I think.
I think it has been explained very well that simply because a person dies does not mean or never meant that their material was going to be published in book form. Ed was involved, independent of myself, in negotiations with Boston College around the time, shortly before the subpoena was issued, for the conditions whereby people would have access to the interviews upon the death of a people. And he was determined to ensure that it would be for a bona fide research exercise, that people could not simply walk in and say, well, let's have a look at it. And there was all manner of discussions and about, you know, speculation at various points, just brainstorming about how these things could eventually become public. Should they be digitized? Should they be put in transcript form and put on the net? So there was no hard and fast rules in relation to it, but there's no point in gathering an oral history if at some point it is not made available to the public. And this is the whole point of doing it, because, I mean, as we have written before the subpoenas even came out, so it's not a new argument on our part. I mean, it was a truth recovery process, and we were trying to bring as much truth and honesty to the Republican end of the war narrative as was possible.
So there's no...
Well, there was no point in bringing out this truth, Alan, if people weren't going to hear it at some point.
You don't fix plan all along as to how that would come out?
No, not at my end.
Yeah.
No, I had always thought long and hard about it, and I had spoke to people, funny enough, after the the publication of Brian Hughes' book, the book on Brown and David Irvine. Yeah. Brian and I was at one night I was at a debate, a discussion in Conway Mill, and some people were critical of the fact that this type of project had went on, and you know, that's the right to have a different viewpoint from me. And others were, some of them wanted it delayed, the material to come out at a time when everybody who was alive and involved in the conflict was dead. And others took the view that the people who were involved in the conflict, the people who were most affected by it, those people had a right, a greater right to hear the stories and to gain a better understanding of the conflict than posterity. So we had different views of it, and I at times was pushed from one to the other and wondering, and I never settled firmly on any one particular view. I was always willing to listen to whatever was put forward.
The whole situation with the project changed, really. Did it change at the point where Dolores said publicly that she had taped interviews? Was that the point where the cat got out of the bag, which led to the possibility that the PSNI could start to get the UK government to ask the US government to help them with an investigation? That was kind of the point they had some kind of leverage?
Well, there's a debate about this. In our affidavits, and in particular in Ed Maloney's affidavit to the US courts and to the court in the North, he is of a view that, and I support him in this, he is of a view that what actually acted as a catalyst for this was a report appeared in the Irish News by Alison Morris about how Alison had interviewed Dolores, Dolores Price, and Alison wrote the report. And 3 days later, Kieran Barnes, the journalist in the Sunday Life, he ran with a report with more details than appeared in Alison's. Now, Kieran's report was used by the authorities in the United States, and they said that Kieran Barnes had said that he had listened to the Boston College tapes. In fact, Kieran Barnes hadn't said that he'd listened to the Boston College tapes as such, but the Attorney General in the U.S. seems to have inferred from his report that he did. And then they moved after that to make a bid to get the tips. So we never really know, I suppose. But in my view, that's what the catalyst was. But what we do have is the U.S. court relying on their interpretation of what Kieran Barnes had said. Now, in Kieran Barnes' own report, I didn't see that he had said that he had read he had heard the tip that she made. He actually referred to Boston University. So I think it was their mischievous or a genuine mistake, but it was their interpretation of his report that, in my view, sent them off in pursuit of this archive.
Boston College put up an initial fight. In the end, you and Ed Maloney have kind of taken your own action kind of independently to try and prevent the stuff being handed across. You've also had action within the Belfast courts to try and make sure that should the stuff actually get handed over, that it wouldn't be released.
Well, that's correct. Boston College put up a Liam fight. They were sort of flickering their eyes at the court. They were trying to. They had told us that a legal strategy would suffice. That we had urged them to engage in a political strategy of contacting other universities, of trying to enlist academic support. And we know that when people approached Boston College to give their support, Boston College basically shunned it. And they went down this legal path, and I think with all intentions of hiding behind the judgment of the court, and the judgment of the court was unfavourable to us, and then they folded completely, and they decided not to appeal, and Jack Dunn, the spokesman for Boston College, put out an enormous amount of erroneous statement, misleading statements, and Montaigne accused Ed Maloney very wrongly of having published the book on his own accord, and having been the only person to have taken royalties. And Ed Maloney quite simply demonstrated through the production of checks that Boston College professors had actually written the foreword to the book.
I was thinking, I remember reading that, yeah.
Had taken royalties and put them in their own personal accounts. Now, which clearly showed the Boston College, while trying to put the blame on Ed for having started the whole thing, were in fact involved in the production of the book. And had there been any risk whatsoever of a subpoena, that was the time for Boston College to raise it. And they didn't raise it. But myself and the Mebbelney sought to intervene in the court, because the judge Young in the Boston courts was, some of the federal courts, was not allowing us to come in and make interventions on our own behalf. We had ceased to have confidence in Boston College's legal strategy. And then the First Circuit ruled against us, and we then have applied to have the case heard in the Supreme Court. And one of the justices put a stay on any handover of the archive until such times as the Supreme Court make a decision on hearing the case.
Which could be quite some time if they ever hear it?
Well, I think I'm led to believe that these things can move pretty quickly, because they actually only hear a very small percentage of the thousands of cases that apply for cert every year. A very small percentage of cases are actually heard. So I think that they do move quickly. And at the moment, we are waiting. We have a number of what are called amicus briefs, the Friends of the Court briefs. Four of those amicus briefs were submitted to the Supreme Court for its consideration. And an amicus brief does not by necessity take a say in this. It merely shows a wider public interest. Now, the government, U.S. government attorney general, tried an old strategy of ignoring our application to the court. And this old strategy is one where if you just do not respond, and the strategic logic in it is that you can, by refusing to respond or failing to respond, you convey to the Supreme Court justices who are considering why or not to hear the case that you are treating it with contempt, and that you're not concerned about it, so you don't even bother going to the expense or time to make a response. What happened after the amicus briefs went in was that the government suddenly asked for more time, and were given until the end of the January, after which we would have 10 days to reply. So there was a degree of seriousness injected into the case, and the government were forced to move. At the moment, that's where it sits. There's still a stay on the material. Nothing is getting handed over, certainly not until that stay is lifted. And there's no saying that the stay is going to be lifted anytime soon. Running parallel with this is Boston Colleges has appealed to the court, the First Circuit Court, to drop the case, given that Dolores Price has unfortunately died. And they said the case is, the whole issue is now moot, and that there should be no further action.
In terms of going forward, either your action will be successful and the stuff won't be handed over, and we'll kind of go back to the way it was 2 or 3 years ago, or some or all of the material will be handed over. If it gets handed over, it doesn't necessarily become public. I mean, I can't see the PSNI kind of put it on their website. They may have very limited success actually using it. It was given on a personal basis. It was given to be only to be kind of really listened to after their death by researchers and so on. It could be a bit of a damp squib.
It could be, and one would hope that it would be, but are we guaranteed anything in the courts in the North? I'm not sure. If it gets to the court stage, even. But the PSNI, I think, are certainly pushing for this with a vigour. And it seems that it goes the whole way up. It may have bypassed the NIO at the start, and then it was handled by the Home Office. But certainly between the PSNI and the Home Office, and I imagine the NIO by this stage, are all on board and are determined to get this material. Now, are they risking so much goodwill? Are they risking annoying the academic establishment just for the sake of having a read at what's there when it'll come out eventually? or do they want it for prosecutions? I believe they want it for prosecutions, and I believe that they also want it for the purposes of some of the elements anyway, want it for the purposes of embarrassing Adams, who does seem to be under pressure these days in relation to many questions that take us back to the past. And, I think this is always going to exist, Alan. You can never really move away from the conflict while people who were central to the past remain central to the present. And I think this sort of thing is always going to dog us. For that reason, I think, I mean, had maybe Mr. Adams and company not been around, the determination to get these arcades would not have been as great as it is.
You talked in a recent interview about the possibility of destroying the archive. Obviously, you don't hold it. Would that not be a terribly sad thing from the history bit of your background and a belief in oral history and wanting to kind of capture this stuff, to turn your back and kind of destroy potentially hundreds of hours of stuff?
I understand how some people would see it that way.
It seems quite drastic from your point of view to be thinking about that.
It's not as drastic as the PSNI getting their hands on it and turning it into evidence. I think the task of a researcher is to protect those who participated in the research from any harmful effects. That's your first objective. That's the ethical imperative. And after that, the interviews don't really matter. Well, in comparison to the welfare of the interviewees.
The majority of whom, of the interviewees, they're alive. So.
Yes, well, I mean, if they're all dead, yeah, keep them. But the fact that they're not, I would be determined to argue the case that to keep the ethics of it, all the stuff should be destroyed before we will allow harm to accrue to those people who took part. And I think that a researcher has an obligation to engage in civil disobedience. And what better civil disobedience than destroying the means that can harm interviewees? It's an academic point, simply because I don't have control of them. I mean, it has been put to Boston College quite some time ago that they had an obligation to destroy these things rather than let them fall into the wrong hands. And if destroying them was the only way to honor their promises, then destruction, so be it. That's the way it would have to be. But Boston College balked at that and then began complaining that one of the reasons they were not prepared to hand any material over to me was because Ed Maloney had said that it should be destroyed. Well, Ed Maloney never suggested at any point that if we got material, it would be destroyed. The whole purpose of us getting material was to protect it and to ensure that it would ultimately be released on the terms that it was given to us on. And but we seen that the suggestion to Boston College, the reaction that it met with was totally cowardly. But Boston College, these rich, powerful institutions, and sometimes the people who defend them, will not engage in civil disobedience. They will expect the researchers, the students, everybody else to take the hit. The institution will take a hit, and it will engage in institutional land to protect itself and its interests.
Do you wish it had been with a different college, under a different set of rules, or...?
Well, I have stated in record before, I regret that I got involved in it, simply because of the harmful effects that it can have on other people. The project is eminently defensible. It was simply done with the wrong university. Both ourselves and the Loyalists relied on the word of the university that had a law school that was prestigious, that was well regarded in Ireland, that had set up its stall in terms of having helped the peace process. We relied on that university with its array of lawyers and wealth to have done the homework, but it turned out that it hasn't, and we have had to pay a terrible price for that. So, in that sense, I regret getting involved with Boston College, yes, very much so. It was an American soil, and we would never have done it had somebody said put in Queens. We wouldn't have felt that it was safe. Boston College led us to believe it was absolutely safe in an American university. We unfortunately, we fell for it, and unfortunately for our research participants, we believe Boston College when we're not by the press.
Lastly, Senator John Kerry, he has now been confirmed or appointed, unanimously agreed that he can be Secretary of State. He's an alumna of the Boston College. I think that's where he did his law. He's previously written to Hillary Clinton when she was in that role. Do you think there's any chance that he'll remember about you when he sits in the big seat behind the big desk?
Oh, he will be reminded about us. Then we move into what they call real politic. And then we will really see what happens when the just how strong the British desire is at the top to get this. Because if John Kerry allows this to be handed over, then we know that the opposition he faced to his motion to quash was very, very strong, and he didn't feel that as a diplomat he could resist it. Now,
does it offer you some hope in that route?
Well, I do. I think there's great hope in the political route if the legal route fails, and I'm hopeful that we will get a result. But there has been some discussion on the this side of the pond that a few nasty PSNI detectives are behind us. A few nasty PSNI detectives wouldn't be able to withstand a rebuke from the Secretary of State in the U.S. Department of State. But the fella up the food chain, it goes in terms of the British deal itself and up to the British Home Office. If they are determined to continue pushing it and are ignoring whatever advice may be coming from the Weatherhead, if indeed there are any at the NIO, then we know that there's a much more malign, nefarious agenda at play here, and what seems to be a total abandonment of the principles pursued by Peter Mandelson and Hayne, the neighbour, at the NIO, because at one time Mandelson actually said that he was not going to pursue extradition of people from the South. It was an absolute waste of time. They were going to serve 2 years anyway. So why are they determined to poke the past? And I think in the coming months we will get a greater understanding of that. I do have a view that one of the motives, and I can't stand over this obviously because I mean we never know these things, but one of the motives is that the British want something strong to bargain with while Sinn Féin and others continue to shout about the past in this one-eyed game of truth and recrimination, which they sometimes call truth and reconciliation. Truth here is we want to tell the truth about you, but we don't want to hear your truth about us. And I think Sinn Féin demanding that the likes of the prosecutions for soldiers on Bloody Sunday and saying that any soldiers convicted will not be afforded the two-year jail sentence, the maximum jail term. I think the British state are going to make it very clear that they too have a card to play here, and that if the past isn't addressed in a proper way, then a way that puts it to rest, then there's trouble for all, and we're caught in the middle. That's my view. High sustainable, that is, and I'm certainly open to persuasion on it.
If the subpoena is blocked and it all goes away, what do you imagine kind of in 10 or 20 years' time people will think about the Troubles based on what they've learnt from the archive? You know, around kind of the truth and reconciliation, just the actual storytelling of stuff, will it have made a significant difference?
Anything that's in the interviews, I do not think that they will people will come away with a view that war is something that should be glorified or conflict is something that should be glorified. People talk at times about this archive as if it's some sort of true detective novel, and they're all waiting to get it so they can look from one page to the next in gory detail. This project was probably, at its root, was an invitation to people to engage in deep moral reflection on the consequences of war and political violence. And I think that's probably the most important point about it, that how people who saw conflict, who were involved in conflict, who experienced conflict, how those people came to see it, how they actually seen it at the time, and how they've come to see it later in life. And I think there are great lessons to be learned from it. I think it's always important to us reflect on the actions that they have been involved in. And I think it always serves as a means to help protect future generations from going down the same path. And I think we very much have to understand why people who would normally be going about a life like yourself or your next door neighbour end up becoming involved in political violence, serious political violence.